Josie, you may have to operate the on-off. Is this mic working? Everybody here in the back of the room? Okay, great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here this morning, and it was a pleasure to visit with Daryl a little bit about our first encounter. That was probably one of the first times I spoke as a professional scientist at the Meat Animal Research Center, and at that time we were very much interested in systems of production or management systems in sheep. And that's one of the reasons I came up to the center, was to work in that area. I became interested in cattle and applying the same principles because of the background I received when I was at Texas A&M University. As we heard last night, Gordon Dickerson was a forward thinker. He understood systems and the systems concept and the application in the beef industry. I had the pleasure of working with a group at Texas A&M University led by Dr. Tom Cartwright. That obviously the two were in tune in their thoughts, and they both thought out of the box. And Tom was very active in moving the concepts or the thought process of systems into his graduate students. Even though my training is in animal breeding, I think I relate more to the systems side than the traditional animal breeding side. Now, that title page was on up there for about 20 minutes. There'll be an open book test at the end what the name of this talk is, so I hope everybody was paying attention. We're talking about efficiency, just a classic definition. It's a measure. It's a quantitative assessment of the effectiveness of resource allocation, be it in energy, time, money, or however we want to describe it. How are we going to apply this in the cow herd? And this is the question today. Are we so tradition-bound that we find ourselves just turning our attention to the same old traits over and over again? If we have information and knowledge about those traits, is this the time and is today's meeting the forum to open our thought process up and move beyond things such as feed conversion, feed efficiency, and perhaps be more concerned about the attributes or the characteristics that we expect a cow to have in a pasture situation? Why revisited in the title? My first participation in a forum like this was in 1984, the Beef Cow Efficiency Forum. It was held in East Lansing, Michigan, and Fort Collins, Colorado, in 1984. The assessment, one of the questions we had when we went in the meeting, what is the effective cow size on efficiency? Other questions, what are the appropriate expressions of biological efficiency? Calf weaning weight, calf weight relative to cow weight, and this index or this ratio is still being considered as a primary indicator. Calf weight per cow exposed, or perhaps calf weight relative to the feed consumed. In other words, how much energy or how much feed did it take me to use my cow herd to produce weight that would go to the marketplace? But we weren't the first. If we go back, we'll find out it's kind of a repetitious or there's a cycle. 1909, Armsby of Pennsylvania State University reported information on energetic efficiency and the juvenile animal, that's the post-weaning animal, and also I'll call it semi or quasi-adult, about 24 months of age. And he noted, and this was the first indication I found in the literature, that there is perhaps genetic variation in the ability for an animal to utilize feed energy for a productive purpose. Or in his sense, not being productive because he's measuring fasting heat production. He used what he called a scrub steer. And this, you can still obtain this article. It's in the National Archives. And he has pictures there. And it definitely, well, we'd call him a ridge runner if I grew up in Arkansas. And he had an improved steer. Had a little more muscularity. But he monitored daily feed intakes for 20 months on these two animals and took periodic measurements of fasting heat production. And his observation was the improved type during this interval up to 24 months of age was more effective in converting feed resources into weight. Then we come into Cliver in 1936, had an excellent article, Cow Efficiency, or How to Improve the Efficiency in the Producing Female. Of course, everybody here is familiar with work there. Sam Brody reported, first time I ever heard of the law of diminishing returns was in his book, and it did not deal with economic situations or business applications. It was talking about the addition of energy above and beyond what an animal is capable of using. you get less bang for your buck as you move on. So these three individuals preceded this conference, and now we're following up a conference. It seems to be about a 20-year radius. Every 20 years, all of a sudden, this topic comes up in a public forum. Okay. Does variation exist in coefficiency, and what can influence this? What I'd like to do in the first series of slides is capture some estimates of coefficiency, primarily focusing on the work that I've been involved with Dr. Cal Farrell at the Meat Animal Research Center in Clay Center. I've summarized the efficiency outputs relative to inputs for cycle 1, cycle 2, and cycle 3 of the Germplasm Evaluation Center at Clay Center. Our initial work involved cycle 1 cattle, 9 to 10-year-old cows, Angus Hereford, Charolais Cross, Jersey Cross, and Simmental Cross. What I've expressed is their efficiency ratios, outputs relative to inputs, to the average of the four breeds. In this particular situation, the black baldy female mated to a third sire breed. Here we're going back to Dickerson again, and our earlier speakers alluded to this several times, that we need to use mating systems to improve the efficiency of output. But the Angus Hereford Cross, back on a third sire breed, was most effective in converting feed energy into weight of the calf, and this is on a per cow exposed basis. The Simmental Cross was the least efficient in this study, and we'll get on to reasons perhaps some of this occurred later on. Cycle 2 involved the Black Baldy, the Brown Swiss, American Brown Swiss, the Pianina Cross, Gelby Cross, and Maine Anjou. The rankings were, again, Angus Hereford and Brown Swiss Cross were the most efficient, and the Maine Anjou and the Gelby, Maine Anjou and the Kianina tended to be of lower rank in this study. The third cycle, again, the black baldies, but now we introduce the Bos Indicus. So we've separated the response, the heterotic response, because they have more divergent breed types, and they, as we would expect, were much more effective, and this is work Dr. Ronnie Green did on his PhD thesis, were much more effective in converting feed energy to weight a calf during a 126-day pre-weaning period. Very little information is in the literature where we look at individual animal variation within a breed. Most of the information that is available to us contrasts the different breeds. And what we can say based on these three studies is, yes, in fact, there is differences, genetic differences out there in the populations we deal with in the way they convert feed energy, mature cow convert feed energy to weight at calf weaning. Okay, two questions. As feed availability varies, does breed rank for efficiency change during the pre-weaning phase? And what is the effect on the output-input ratio? We looked at cycle 4, a germplasm evaluation, black baldy cross, shorthorn, Galloway, longhorn, Nalor, and Solers. We varied the amount of feed energy available to him during the lactation period, and our ratio was pounds of calf wean per unit of feed consumed by the dam during this period. So the questions we want to ask is, what happens? Are there differences among the breeds again? And yes, as we look across the spectrum from roughly 2,500 units of energy up to 6,800 pounds of energy going into the animals, we see that there's differences, or the breeds rank. The greatest separation is here at the lowest intake levels. By the time we got out to the super, I'll call it the super nutrient environment, very little differences among the breeds in production efficiency. Now, another question. If we interpret this graph just as it stands, it says the least we feed the cows, by far and away, biologically, they're going to be most efficient. That makes sense. If I can feed her 1 pound and wean a 1,000-pound calf, boy, that's efficiency. But we know this doesn't work for the simple reason we're dealing with the biological system in these cows. So even though we're measuring something of economic value, this animal still has to exist, and her drive, or these population drives, are to reproduce. And to reproduce, that means they have to be able to conceive. They have to be able to deliver a calf. That calf has to be able to walk. That calf has to be able to weaned off and go on to maturation so that set of genes can be passed on. At this level here, my speculation would be that when the calf's on the ground, her reproductive performance is going to cease, so she will be open the next year. So this is not what we want. Obviously, we have to find some point in here that it all works. The other question that comes up, at the point of economic, biological, maximum biological efficiency at 165 days of weaning, these are the type of weaning weights that we're going to get. I don't think that we'd be too proud to throw those type of calves in the back of our pickup and take them into the marketplace. Not even say anything about when the banker comes in to collect the note. Now, if we have a 60% increase in feed availability, we can ask the question, what happens to weaning weight? What we realize or capture is about a 40% increase in the weaning weights of these calves. Again, these calves are early weaned. They're 165 days. That's why these weights are substantially less than what we normally turn off at the center. So the question becomes, as I move along this curve here, these curves, is what point does economics come in and dictate how much feed I'm going to supply to that cow that she's going to carry on to the calf? And these weights, by the way, are all produced by milk produced by the cow. The calves did not have access to any exogenous feed resources. So we made it through the last, I guess, looking at the pre-weaning period, saying there's 100% reproductive efficiency. So a project was started in 1988, went through 1993. We monitored the individual feed intake of cows from all these breeds represented here for a five-year period. We monitored reproductive performance, not only conception rate, but also postpartum interval. What we observed, and to give you a brief background, we fed the representatives from each one of these breeds at different levels of dry matter availability, using a high-quality alfalfa hay as our feed resource. So protein was assumed not to be a limiting factor. Our efficiency measure, as illustrated here, is grams of calf weaned per kilogram of consumed of cows exposed. And this is summarized over a five-year period, so it's just not a yearly snapshot, but we have a continuum of values. And what we observe is there's a change in ranking in biological efficiency. Here at on the left side, as we view the graph, at 3,000 kilograms of dry matter per year, we have a ranking of Red Pole Angus and Pinsgauer as being more efficient, and then we get into our continental types as being less efficient in rank. For a long period of time, there's arguments in the literature whether there's really any differences in cow efficiency. And what happened, if you go back and study the literature, most of those data were collected between 4,000 and 5,500 kilograms of feed availability or some measure of energy content that is in this range. And then in our data, we again find out that there's no real differences among breeds in the ability to convert feed energy to weight at calf at weaning. There is obviously a lot of noise, and we see trend line starting where we have a change in rank. And by the time we get over here again to this supra-nutrient environment, our ranking is now Charolais, Pinsgauer, Limousin, Simmental, Brondi, Gelby. And then here, the leaders from this side are now of lowest rank for biological efficiency. So the question is, what's going on? What we observed in the data, and we'll talk about this in a little more detail later in the presentation, on this side, reproduction is a constraint to the system. As we increase genetic potential for growth and milk production, we inherently carry an increased debt load of energy cost. Whether the cow is in the productive phase or not, in productive phase I mean whether she is pregnant or lactating, we have found in our data, and we'll again talk later about it, that as you increase the genetic potential for performance, you increase costs associated with maintenance. As we move to the central part or the middle part of this graph, feed availability is sufficient that these cows, these higher producing type of animals, are no longer penalized with regard to reproduction. We're using a 90-day breeding season, natural service. These cows were able to cycle, had a relatively short postpartum interval, and they would rebreed during lactation. We get over here in the supra-nutrient environment. All of a sudden now, those animals were most efficient over here. They were able to reproduce, produce a calf. In fact, the red pole at this level weaned a calf to about 220 pounds at 200 days age. But she weaned a calf. That calf went into the post-weaning period, and within about 12 weeks, it caught up with its contemporaries. But we get over here, we now have enough energy available in the system that the genetic potentials for growth and lactation can be captured, can be harvested, and be marketed. These animals, or these breeds, in this particular sector, Red Poll, Angus, and Hereford, were now becoming obese. They were consuming so much energy that they were depositing it on their back as opposed to delivering the milk supply to the calves to be harvested as weaning weight by producers. All right. We need to look at some of the characteristics contributing to an efficient cow. I've got things in major categories: milk, fertility, survival, growth, and nutritive, or nutrition, or genetic potential for energy use. These are the things we tend to talk about when we get together in a group. They're easy classifications. Everybody can visualize this. If I say the milk EPD for a given breed, we all instantly say, yeah, I know that really what it is. Or if we say growth, everybody assumes we're talking about pre-weaning growth, post-weaning growth, weight at 205, 12 months, or some indication like this. But I think if we ever broke these traits down, or these characteristics, we may talk about yield at time of peak lactation, total yield during the lactation, and persistency. Our colleagues in the dairy industry talk about persistency all the time. I've never heard it addressed in the beef cattle industry. I wonder, and there's a slide, I think Mike Tess had a slide last night, showed the change in genetic predictions for the trend lines in milk production. They were upwards and going on. Are we really selecting or changing the lactation curve? Are we changing persistency of lactation, since our measurement is usually associated with a weaning weight by 210 or 205 days of age? What change are we affecting in the system? And this is kind of a two-edged sword. If, in fact, the tendency is cows that have high peak lactations at about 70 days postpartum tend to have a relatively rapid decline in the amount of milk being produced in the latter part of lactation. So she has an unfavorable persistency. But Mother Nature made it that way, because then when she dries up, or it's time for her to cease lactation, she'll have less, require less time to become dry, gives her more time to recapture body condition to get her ready for the next reproductive cycle so she can again move forward her gene pool. Now, if we have flattened this curve out and we say, all right, we're selecting for persistency, perhaps the peak lactation is going to be lowered. A lot of our breeds have yields at 60 to 70 days postpartum that the calves can't handle all the milk. And this creates management problems. We can go through the rest of these. All of appetite. We heard about this last night. Appetite, again, is another one of these ubiquitous statements. What is appetite? It's feeding behavior. That's part of it. It's the amount of ingestion over a period of time. That's part of it. We also have foraging ability. We never talked about that. Selectivity. In sheep and goats, we know that they're very careful about going out and taking the heads of plant in order or trying to ensure that they receive the part that has the highest level of protein. There is evidence in the literature that some types of cattle do the same thing. This is something we need to talk about. Energetic efficiency and energy partitioning. These, again, traits that go under this component. In growth, again, measures of weight, growth rate, and component parts. Last night, we saw two of our speakers provided information about altering the growth curve. What do we really alter when we alter the growth curve? Survival, that's calf survival, calving ease, soundness. One of the papers at the 1984 meeting was by Dr. Jim Gibb, and he was talking about functional traits, or functionality. And soundness was something he stressed very much, but again, we hear very little about it in the literature today. Longevity is another one. Fertility, ability to cycle, conceive, gestation length, postpartum interval, and fecundity. Again, we talk about our conception rates, we talk about weaning weights. When's the last time someone said, do you know what fraction of a calf we actually market that actually goes into the finishing plant relative to the national cow herd? Over a bottle of scotch one time, a friend and I undertook this discussion, and using the best statistics available at that local pub, and given the time of night, we figured out less than 0.6 of a calf is actually marketed into the food chain on a national average. We went back and we checked those figures. We got some USDA figures, looked at the national herd inventory relative to the animals slaughtered. And that's roughly right. So if we start talking about marketing animals per cow, I think what we need to do is not talk about weaning rates or conception rates, but actually how many of those make it into the market system. I want to go through each one of these and take a look at what we know or what we think we know about them. We've evaluated 21 breed crosses with regard to lactation traits, and primarily peak yield and total yield, as well as 9 straight breeds that were involved in germplasm utilization project conducted by Dr. Keith Gregory at the Mead Animal Research Center. There is variation in peak milk yield. This is a daily estimate of the yield approximately 70 days postpartum. It ranges usually from 56 to about 80 days, a range among the breeds. So we do have opportunity there to exploit differences among breeds in putting together a female. Given the conversations with Dr. Cundiff, I'm firmly convinced as much as variations we see between breeds, we'll find as much variation within breeds. The problem is, how do we measure it? It always fascinates me to see dairy people get these young heifers in and put them on machines the first time and how nice they stand, relatively nice they stand. We try to touch the udder on some of these cows coming in out of our pastures, and we lose a lot of health that way. So I really don't know how we're going to get a handle on this. Perhaps we can find some traits that are correlated that are more easily measured. Total yield, again, variation. This is for 210 days from about 4,000 pounds down to a low of about 2,500 pounds. And I understand that we are making improvement within the breeds with regard to this, or at least our genetic prediction is we are making improvements. All right. What we have also found is that we have an interaction, and this is peak milk yield, associated with feed availability. Now, why this is critical is even though the milk may not be expressed, say, here at the lower levels, the genetic potential, the energetic cost, the extra load of having high genetic potential for milk production is part of the system. You're going to have to feed that cow. Excuse me, I'll back this up. At low levels of feed intake, she's carrying a heavier energy debt load than you give her credit for, because the maintenance of costs associated with higher milk production ability is still there, whether she receives the feed and whether she expresses the milk or not. We move up here in the higher levels. One of the breeds plateaued, had no effect. In other words, here at the medium level, we have maximum expression of milk, peak milk yield. We've looked the other way. We actually see enhancement in peak milk yield. This breed, obviously, we were underfeeding, and since we did not, was not able to see a bending trend with the three levels, I'm going to assume if we kept feeding her at higher levels, she would produce more milk as a female, maternal attribute. Persistency, a reduced rate of reduction in milk production. I think this is an attribute or a characteristic that as beef cattle producers, we need to pay more attention to. Our colleagues, again, in the dairy area have recognized this as a contributor to the economic or production function. Again, how do we measure it? How do we measure it? I don't really know. Okay, the nutritional component. Well, the first thing, if we're going to improve something, we've got to have some variation. Oh boy, Cal and I have been able to find a lot of variation in the work we're doing. We have trouble explaining what causes it. Some of the things we have looked at, metabolizable energy intake on a metabolic size and average daily gain expressed the same way. This is maintenance level across a number of different breeds, either slightly above or slightly below dead maintenance. But look at the range and weight changes that we have. There's tremendous variation there. How can we exploit this variation? Again, I don't have the answer. On the other side, if we go up here to very high levels of energy intake, look at the range and change in average daily gain. So again, opportunity. This is some of the information or some of the variation we're attempting to exploit. The Australians had brought up last night, I think Dr. Johnson's going to talk about it later, and residual feed intake. Can we identify those individuals, juvenile individuals, that are more effective in converting feed energy to a final product, be it average daily gain or weight at a given time? Well, appetite. Again, one of those deals we're starting to hear more about. We really don't understand what it is. Using the nine breeds from the germplasm utilization study, we took a look at what an attempt to measure appetite in a mature female. These are open females, and we did a very simple approach. We'd feed them until they stopped growing, and the feed that they consumed, where they had zero weight gain, we would define as their maximum relative appetite. So among the breeds, and then we ran some curves, just looking, again, very similar to the residual feed intake concept. This would be a population curve here. We asked the question, where do these breeds rank with regard to appetite? On this side of the curve would mean their drive to consume feed exceeds the average of the population. Breeds on this part are below the curve. Their drive to consume feed, and these are all ad-lib fed animals, is lower than the average of the population. Some have pointed out that the limousine had some problems with feed intake, much like the Texel. Again, very lean, very effective in converting feed energy to lean. Perhaps a limiting constraint for this breed would be, or be an attempt to move their appetite up a little more so we could express their genetic potential for growth. We have Red Pole, Angus, and Hereford up in this quadrant. I would say that their drive to feed is to overfatten. They have been used in the past more as a maternal type. Is this an indication that Mother Nature would like to have this maternal type an easy fattener? I don't know. Then we get the Pinsgar, Galby, and Bromby here right about the population average. And the real anomaly was the Charolais out here at about 1,550 pounds, saying that they had an above-average appetite. We did slaughter all these animals. We have an indication of their empty body composition. This quadrant is very much the fattest group of cattle we had, but all cows that we slaughtered out of these groups exceeded 28% empty body fat. So they do fatten. It takes a period of time. These cattle, in order to get this estimate, we fed these open dry cows to get them stabilized over 14 months. So again, not an effective attribute to try to characterize in the beef industry if we're going to select for production efficiency. We need to find a trait in a juvenile animal that we can correlate to this. All right, energy partitioning. This is just the linear model that we've tended to use over the years. If we consume feed and we can ME intake, it's either split into production or maintenance. And my point is going out, so I apologize. Okay, the production side then has an efficiency of use to go into non-fat, say protein accretion, be it in milk production, conceptus, weighted calf or weaning, or weight of an individual. And then we have that that goes into fat. Our interest in the past, there's a few estimates in the literature, indications that there's differences in these efficiencies of converting among animals and being able to convert energy to protein or to fat. And part of the reason is the difficulty in measuring this. So I don't think that we have an opportunity to exploit this type of variation, even if it's there. If you can't recognize it, you can't measure it, you can't utilize it. But we have a lot of work that's starting to go on in this area. We have this efficiency, we have animals, you have to meet the maintenance requirements before you go into production. It's not quite this simple. This is a sliding scale. And in fact, there's a relationship between production, as we've mentioned earlier, between production and maintenance. So it's not all this energy is going to go to maintenance first and then we'll go into production. It's a sliding scale. There's some of it, as I increase the availability of feed, more and more of what I consume as an animal is diverted towards a productive function. As it's lowered, then more and more is converted to the maintenance side. So there's a sliding effect that we're dealing with here. Energy expenditure in mature cows, 73%, based on our studies, Dr. Farrell and mine, is expended in maintenance. This is quite an overhead. So very early, we jumped on the bandwagon saying that this is the component we really want to address. This is what we'd like to do. This is the opportunity for us to reduce or improve biological efficiencies if we can reduce the maintenance component. Gestation, about 7% of the feed consumed during the year, and about 20% for lactation. Right. We started a series of studies, given our epiphany, our knowledge that maintenance requirements are critical, and we found variation among breeds, mature cows, 8, 9, 10-year-old cows, open dry cows, and their ability to support their body weight or maintenance. Again, the trend seemed to be that it wasn't size per se that had the major effect on maintenance requirements, but more importantly, it was ability to produce milk. If there's a breed has the ability to be a superior milk production type of animal, then the maintenance costs associated with that breed, and remember these are measured in dry cattle, so this is an overhead that's there year-round, beyond production costs of the extra milk, they tended to be of higher rank. The Brown Swiss, the Simmental was in the Cycle 1, had the highest maintenance energy requirements. We started some additional work. Here we compared the fasting heat production of mature Hereford and Simmental cows over two production cycles. We actually used head boxes and measured their fasting heat production. What we observed is the Hereford, which I'm going to use a poor choice of words, but they were lower rank with regard to production traits in our trials. These are straight bred Herefords. At the lowest energy availability, had exhibited lowest fasting heat production. The converse of that, they were more efficient. They were better able to sustain themselves. Our Simmentals were about 20% higher. However, as I improve the feed efficiency, I have more energy retained per unit change in the Simmental, the high-producing type, than I do in the Hereford. This suggests to us perhaps that maintenance is not static. It's a dynamic component, and it interacts with the nutritional environment. And we have to realize this as we design breeding programs to improve cow efficiency. Well, that last slide really got Cal and I worried. We said, if we realize our wish to reduce maintenance expenditure in cows, will we really get what we want? I mean, everybody's heard that as saying, be careful what you wish for because you might get it. Again, using the Angus, Bromby, Charolais, Gialby, Hereford, Red Pole, the GPU type cattle, I left one or two off, I think, because of space. We asked the question, maintenance efficiency. How many pounds of weight can be maintained per unit of energy in the system? And what we find, there's several points I want to make in this slide. One, maintenance is dynamic. Maintenance efficiency is dynamic. Here, these type of cattle are very efficient in the sense that they supported a lot of weight, 15 pounds per unit of energy intake. We move over here through the productive phase, 76 to 93, and this is kind of how we picture this. This is where we'd expect production to be. Animals become, breeds became more similar in their maintenance efficiency. We move over here into, again, the ad-lib environment, and we see a tendency to plateau. There's been work previously, Dr. Claire Taylor, in Europe, Great Britain, Scotland, had suggested that maintenance efficiency is proportional to body weight. And so this is one of the ideas that we were challenging. We found out in a given range of feed intakes, this may again be true. We measured efficiency, we measured maintenance in these cattle by, again, feeding them until they stop changing weight on a given level of feed intake. So this is a direct measure of maintenance. But what intrigued us was this breed right here, the Red Pole. They really did not change their maintenance efficiency that much. Now, if you recall the production graph earlier where we was looking at biological efficiency, the Red Pole were the most efficient at that lowest level of feed intake. They conceived every year they produced a calf, every year they weaned a calf, where the other breeds might be skipping every third year. So maybe if we start trying to make them very efficient at this low level of energy intake, or we try to change this maintenance component, we're going to move away from the very animal we want into these type of animals that are going to shut down their reproductive performance. We have to be careful to understand that we're dealing with a biological system, and even though we're measuring very category-type traits, it has a tremendous influence throughout the system. Growth. This is, I think, Dave. No, it might have been Mike who brought this up last night. The current tonnage of carcass beef is approximately equal to that produced in the late 1970s and the 1980s. And we're doing with it about 23% fewer mother cows. We've made changes since that last growth efficiency symposia. We had trend line, the mother cows is down. Our tonnage produced is up. Several different ways we've done that. That's raising the bar as far as slaughter weights. We know that. Can you imagine if we had the population of mother cows we did in 1980 and have increased that bar weight, what our commodity prices would be today? So the system adjusts as we go. But what I find intriguing is I go back and look at height at the hooks of Angus and Hereford rig crosses from GPE for five cycles. Okay, cycle one, cycle two, and cycle three, Dr. Kunda sampled semen from the mid-60s. He went back out to the industry and sampled for cycle four and cycle five. Look what happened to our height measurements. We went from 48 inches mean on these cattle to 50, up to 53 inches. And I would guess that if I looked at cycle six and seven, we'd see continued increase. So we have changed the growth potential even in some of our base populations, Angus and Herefords, here in the country. Okay, component of the body exhibits a growth curve. We talked about bending the growth curve last night. Well, what are we going to burn? If we look at a ranking of developmental order as far as growth curves, the nervous tissues are the earliest maturing, followed by visceral, skeletal, muscle tissues for locomotive, and muscle tissues for reproduction. Well, that makes sense. The first thing a calf or an embryo has to be able to do is respond to stimuli. So to do that, he needs a central nervous system. So that's going to be earliest maturing. Then he has to be able to process the food or energy supplies, protein, nutrients coming into the system, so visceral tissue. He has to be able to have a framework to hang things on, skeletal tissue. He has to be able to move. And the primary thing that newborn, probably up to the age of puberty, is to be able to get away from enemies, even though we've modified the environment as cattle producers, so this is not quite as important as it used to be. And the last component is reproduction. And this is Dr. Brody's work from 1942. We've known this. So if we start trying to bend the growth curve, what are we doing to these things? All right, this is 1984. I threw this up at the symposium at Michigan State and half the crowd left. Now, and I hope you don't hear, because actually this was brought up last night. They talked about Dr. Dickerson. This is his influence on Craig Leimaster and myself. Path coefficients. How do you explain the functional relationships about different parts of the system? Okay, at that time that we put this together, everybody was emphasizing post-weaning average daily gain. They said, this is the way we need to go. We're looking at the end point. No one was asking the question, well, how about the constituent parts that contribute to average daily gain? So Craig and I asked a simple question. In a juvenile animal, if we took the average daily gain and partitioned out the variation with the component traits, carcass lipid, protein, and fat, or excuse me, ash, and offal lipid, protein, and ash, which one of these segments actually accounted for most of the variation in average daily gain? It's a very simple question. It's the type of question that Gordon Dickerson would ask that everybody else fails to see why you need to ask it. What we found and what came out of this study is that actually the greatest influence on this post-weaning average daily gain came from the offal protein. The visceral component is a driver, if you want to look like this. The visceral component is also the greatest expending organ group of energy. It's the largest contributor to the maintenance fraction. So as we tried to improve growth rate by selecting directly for average daily gain, we inadvertently were selecting for increased offal mass, protein mass, which would probably increase, we expected to increase the maintenance requirements. Now, as we're going to work our way back and start talking about developing selection indices to improve efficiency, we need to take these type of factors into consideration. Fertility. Well, we've been very effective in selecting for scrotal circumference in bulls, and it's had a positive effect. Excuse me, it has had an effect on age of puberty. I have a colleague at the center that thinks perhaps we've gone too far. But that's his problem. All right. Effect of varying energy intake on postpartum interval. Again, here is an attribute, a characteristic that we normally don't talk about. In the study with the nine breeds, what we found in those cattle on the lowest level of feed intake that had the highest performance, they would not returned to estrus until they ceased lactating. If they had a calf on the ground, it seems like Mother Nature has instilled in them a process that says, if you don't have enough energy coming in the system, I will not let you create or have an opportunity to create an embryo to go in place. We're going to get this calf on the ground weaning it out into the population. We classified the cattle with regard to size, medium milk, high milk, high size or high body mass, medium milk, medium size, high milk, and high and high. What we observe is that size had a greater influence on the postpartum interval at lowest level intake 140 days before they started recycling. We're down in the remaining three classifications from about 85 to 105 days. If we go into the ab-lib environment, there's very little differences among them, and we're down to about 45 to 65 days. So postpartum interval, there's genetic variation there that appears to be associated with production traits that we want to measure and we want to change. But yet, do we understand how that's going to impact the reproductive side? Dr. Tess said last night that he thinks, and he's fairly confident, that the nutritional environment in the Montana cattle industry is quite a bit different today than it was 20 years ago. I support his statement. I say, as we make improvement in beef cattle, one of the biggest things that we improve is the environment that we expect them to perform in, and we do not recognize that. The trouble is, when we then ship these animals out to that different type of environment, the people we ship them to cannot capture the gains that you've made. My observations. Well, I don't have a real good definition of cow efficiency. To me, it's one that weans a calf every year, year in, year out. And I think there's some cattle operations that adhere to this philosophy. If they can get a cow that calves on their production scenario every year, they generally move into a multiplier herd for females to come back in. So this is what an efficient cow is. She is someone that has modified herself to your production environment. You didn't modify your environment to meet her genetic potential. Variation exists among and within breeds for phenotypes we now associate with cow efficiency. And a lot of my work over the years, last 20 years, is trying to identify these different characteristics and ask the question, is there variation among breeds? Because I feel very confident that there's variation among breeds, there's variation within. What are novel phenotypes or phenotypes of an efficient cow? Can we think beyond what we've traditionally done, say, since 1909, if we start there with Arnsby? Can we think past weights? Can we think past growth rate? Can we move into something that perhaps we can utilize with the new tools that are coming out? As mentioned last night, that Dr. Cook suggested residual feed intake as an alternative to selection for feed efficiency in 1963. There's a paper in 1946 by Beverly in the Poultry Science suggested the same thing. This is my first time I found out about residual feed intake. They have several lines of chickens that have been selected over 100 generations for residual feed intake. They're starting to evaluate the physiological responses to this type of selection. And they've had some interesting results. The correlated responses are quite different whether you select on the juvenile animal or whether you select on the mature adult. Of course, their production traits are a little bit different. They're adjusting for than what we have. In a juvenile animal, they're still using their dam's performance with regard to egg drop, egg mass, and things like this, as well as growth rate. But when they selected on the juvenile, the response was different to their target than what they had when they selected on the adult animal directly. What tools? Genomics is here. This group here should help define, for us scientists, phenotypes that we should start collecting data, phenotypic data on, that we can then challenge our scientists that work in the genomic area, say, here, we have this. Can you correlate this to a segment on the genome? Can you put it in a position that a cattle producer can cost-effectively utilize your information to identify in young females, those females that are going to be efficient in the production scenario when she's a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old cow. Replacement heifer cost for commercial producers is one of their first complaints. They talk about that 2-year-old heifer coming back in that first calf and how many they have to replace. That's a high debt load. If they could get more of those coming back in production, not have to replace 20-25% at that time, that's more calves of higher value, if you talk about value added, going to the marketplace as opposed to those open heifers. So what tools and how can we best employ them? If the genetic prediction is the way that we're going to go, then perhaps work that's going on to tie genetic predictions and genomic information together will move us forward. But what is critical is we have to identify different phenotypes from what we traditionally measure. And this is a challenge to this group. Well, I try to read a book every once in a while. I didn't get one read today or this last year, but I found a quote from Anna Karenina. And actually, it's referred to as the Anna Karenina principle. It's the opening sentence in the book. It reads, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." That's a profound statement. That's just saying that when everything's synchronized and working well, gosh, it looks like a simple process. But if we get into discontent or discord, even within the family unit, there may be a multitude of reasons why they're falling apart. Well, we can modify that. That's what's fun about reading. Efficient cows are all alike. Every inefficient cow is inefficient in its own way. Now, think about that. I mean, it is a very simple statement. But when I say this cow over here is inefficient, what am I really saying? Am I saying that she failed to have a short enough postpartum interval that she conceived on a timely basis? Maybe she just got one cycle while that bull was out there. I'd much rather have, in a 60-day breeding season, an opportunity for 2 conception opportunities. So again, thank you very much for your attention this morning.